Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to Getting Savvy in Health, Wealth, and Beauty. Important to note that everything is for entertainment purposes only. Please do speak and meet with a financial advisor before making any investment decisions. And also, please meet and speak with your GP before making any health or beauty decisions.
All right, Melissa, we've got a lot to discuss. There's been so much that's been happening over the past week or so. So what I want to cover today is everybody, I'm sure, has heard about DeepSeek, this new player in AI development out of China. It actually stemmed from a hedge fund. So we're going to talk about that and the impact that's had on the market. And what do I mean for AI going forward? You've also been really interested in just to learn about bonds. What is it like to invest in a bond? What does it mean? How do you do it? So we're going to do that. But I also want to talk a little bit more about dividend investing, because both give you income, but from different ways. And then also, of course, my goodness, the tariffs and the impact that that's had on the markets and the Canadian dollar and what it might mean for our Canadian economy. Over to you.
Yeah, this past week has just been huge in terms of political news, in terms of economic news, and in terms of health news. So there's a lot to unpack. A few things that I wanted to touch on in health news was, number one, the FDA approved a non-opioid pain medication. This is exciting because this is the first new class of pain medication to be approved in over 20 years. And what's so exciting about it also is that it is a non-addictive type of pain medication. So we'll definitely talk about that. I was also going to talk about a study I saw that showed that dietary calcium cuts colorectal cancer risk by 17%. So as we've seen in the news, more young people are getting cancer. Incidences are going up, and it's good to know what not to do and also what we can do proactively to help reduce our rates. Mm-hmm. Also a study that showed that social media use is linked to irritability. So no big shock there.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of GLP-1 news, there was an article in USA Today showing that 2/3 of people quit GLP-1 drugs within a year of starting them. And leading off with that, we'll then also talk about RFK Jr. and the Senate votes Tuesday on whether he'll become the new Secretary of Health and Human Services. So lots to do
today.
Okay, and then, excitingly, we have some Q&A. So we'll do some questions that people have written into us about Botox on my end and for you.
NVIDIA. NVIDIA. Okay, so a lot to get through. I'm going to first just start with the tariffs that have been imposed. I should say that we are filming this on Sunday, February the 2nd. And we do know over the weekend that it has been confirmed that 25% tariffs on Canada as well as Mexico. It has been reduced, though, for our Canadian energy. So 10% on the Canadian energy exports to the United States. This is effective as of February the 4th. So, you know, I guess a couple of things. Look, I think there's still a lot of unknowns in terms of the impact that this is going to have on the Canadian economy, let alone the U.S. economy. And big picture, stepping back, what does it mean to the inflation picture, right? If companies are getting essentially taxed more, do they pass it on to the consumers? Does that increase our cost of living for various goods that we should expect to be hit with? So such as beer, wine, bourbons, fruits, clothing, household appliances. That's, you know, those are some of the key areas that that we're going to hit the U.S. with. So what does that mean in terms of our costs? So I think we all have to be prepared for that, and we are. And at the same time, from a markets perspective and an economy perspective, we don't know how long this is going to last. We don't know really if this is all about border security, which we think it is, for fentanyl and illegal immigrants. And then also, is it a negotiating tool? And I read something from, you know, one of my favorite research houses. It's a global research house. And it's interesting when they look at Trump's first term versus second term. If you recall back, the first term was really about made in America, right? It's making America great again, but it's bringing everything home. It's interesting to look at perhaps what is going on now. Rather than being an isolationist approach, this is really about asserting U.S. dominance from a global perspective. And I think it's an interesting shift in your mindset to think about as we look at the United States and what he's doing even on foreign policy, even with Israel, with Russia, with Ukraine. I think it's a bit of a Panama, Greenland. It's a bit of a different approach. And I think within that, just again, from a market's perspective, and just a human perspective, there's going to be some volatility. There is some volatility. And importantly as well, when we think about the tariffs, I've said this before, look at the currencies, foreign exchanges. So currencies, foreign exchange, FX, reflects the story of the moment. And we did see the Canadian dollar dip below 69 cents. There's reasons for that. Obviously, the tariffs, a weaker economy. We've already been in a weak economy. We have no federal leadership and we're scrambling.
Did you watch Trudeau address the nation yesterday? You may not have because I know you're in the US right now. Did you
watch? No.
You know, I did. So I watched it live. And as Trudeau often does, and he's a wonderful speaker, he speaks well. And I actually think to the average person watching this, it's crazy. It's like the US is supposed to be our neighbor, our ally, our best friend. We're in things together. And now it sort of feels like they're picking a fight with us. And we're in this fight. And it's like we were besties. And are we now frenemies? Like, what happened? And it's like, it must be over a guy. Maybe that guy is Trudeau.
God.
I don't know. But I will say he did a good job in basically saying that, you know, he thinks it's unfounded. He thinks we do have border security and that will get even better and that we'll have to retaliate. And I know a lot of people in Canadian businesses that are affected are really nervous. Like I'm on this group. I'm in a group called WPO, which is the Women's President's Organization.
Hmm.
And on WhatsApp last night, it was just going crazy with a lot of women who are in businesses that export to the US being like, this is a disaster. They're going to mm-hmm. have layoffs. Their businesses mm-hmm. falter. And, you know, it's very scary, I think, what's going to happen on both ends of things. And it all of a sudden makes you feel, it feels like we had this really good sharing relationship. And now all of a sudden it's like, it's mine. It's yours. Oh, where's this made from? I've never even thought to look if this is made in Canada versus the US. It felt like it was joint before. So to your point with Trump, you know, yes, it's a different approach, but you know, if all of a sudden it's going to be so much more expensive for Americans to buy these products from Canada, it's going to force them to make in America, make their own, make it, you know. So it just seems very punitive for this fentanyl. I mean, I realize the fentanyl yeah. isn't too crossing the border. It just seems like we could have also said, hey guys, can you do a better job? Thanks.
As well, you know what though, in fairness, but they've had 4 years.
Fair. If that's the case, if Biden was asking them.
Well, okay. Right. But I think too, you know, I don't think we've had enough border security, and you can see it even with the violence that we have in our own country. There are
as bad as Mexico.
I don't know. I don't know where the gangs are coming in from, but they're coming in and we're a much smaller population.
I don't know about Canadian cartels.
Well,
I don't know.
Very
punitive, and obviously he has a reason for it, and I hope it doesn't last long. I'm just so worried about what it means for our Canadian dollar getting even worse. Like it just seems like it's obviously
yeah.
going down further,
and I want to point out at the same time too, we have no federal leadership.
Yeah.
That's an issue. How can you lead a country in a tariff war when the government doesn't exist, number one? And number two, the people who are trying to get this leadership for the Liberal Party, Carney's still talking about increasing carbon taxes and
so ridiculous. Yeah.
No, they're fighting a different war. There's an AI arms race going on right now. That's US and China. And then there's a tariff war going on. Get it together. So we will see what the impact will be. But I think that, you know, you can expect volatility. You can expect a foreign exchange, a currency that probably continues to decline. And everybody needs to recognize that, you know, even if I don't travel to the United States or whatever it is, we are importing goods with a lower value dollar. And that just increases your personal cost for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're going to feel some pain. I do think it will be inflationary. And, you know, I follow, obviously, Polyev. I've been watching his posts, and he speaks so eloquently and intelligently on these issues. I think Canada has to really join together and understand, like you said, that we're in this trade war right now. And hopefully we can, you know, kiss and make up.
Right. Okay, kiss and make up. Absolutely. Well, we hope so. And most people always can. You know, I would just say too, when you think about, you know, what the Canadian economy looks like right now, we did get our GDP. It did come in lower than expected. We also had results from CN Rail. So you might ask, well, why do I care about a railway company's earnings? Well, you do, because think about it. They transport goods. The more goods, the more carloads, the less demand for goods, less able to afford goods, the fewer carloads happen. And that obviously affects CN's revenue as well as their profit. And they did have revenue that was down 3% versus 3% and profit that was down 10%. So it's an interesting barometer. You know, we always talk about companies telling a story about the economy and how we live. And that's why I find it also interesting. It's a barometer for the economy. And so the stock is actually at a 52-week low. I'm going to bring up a stock here. And it's trading at 19 times, that's a multiple price over earnings. That's from another episode. But historically, the five-year average is about 22 times. So it's at a discount from a valuation perspective from where it would normally trade. So I'm only bringing this up because, you know, there will be portfolio managers out there, big money managers who might say, hey, this is a great deal for me right now. Because I do believe, to our point in talking about all this, we might kiss and make up, the economy might grow stronger, and that will be reflected in the company stock. So that's kind of tying in what we're talking about to an actual investment in a company that's been affected. That's been affected, right?
Yeah. And you were mentioned also how this has affected gold in Canada and how that...
So gold, right. So when there's a fear trade going on right now, which is what I would call this, right? Fear trade, meaning the tape reflect means like the markets, they call it the tape, the trade. Gold tends to be viewed as a safe haven. And so gold has hit another high, the price of gold. So people are buying gold when they feel that, you know, the Canadian dollar, we don't know where it's going. Let me put my money in gold. So that's one of the things you'll also tend to see is a price of gold that moves higher. And that's exactly what we're seeing. So you can look at the currency, you can look at the price of gold, and that reflects, obviously gold isn't just bought in Canada, it's bought around the world. So obviously other countries as well, Europe doesn't necessarily know what's going to happen to them. China, we'll see what the relationship there looks like. So there's probably a lot of big portfolio managers and money managers and even in countries that are buying up gold. So that's a quick overview on the tariffs and the markets. Talk to me a little bit more about, I'm kind of curious, what's this new non-opioid painkiller?
Yeah, this is super exciting. So the FDA approved this non-opioid painkiller. I believe it's called sertraline. Let me look, because these names always have suzetrigine, also known as Cannabix. It's by Vertex Pharmaceuticals.
So oh, yeah.
Got a big bump.
Yeah.
Recently. And what's interesting about it is so other painkillers that you would have heard of. So, you know, Percocet, OxyContin, fentanyl, everything Trump's talking about that's led to this whole huge massive addiction crisis in the US and globally, frankly. So the opiates work because they bind to opioid receptors in the brain, okay, that are involved with pain. And that's why they help with pain. But when they do that, at the same time, it also floods the system with dopamine. Now, dopamine is a feel-good, euphoric chemical. So people like that feeling and they tend to get addicted. And this is why we have this huge opioid crisis. New drug that Vertex Pharmaceuticals made, this suzetrigine, works by a different mechanism. So it's a sodium channel blocker. So it blocks pain signals before they reach the brain. Therefore, it is not believed to have this addictive potential like opiates do. So I think the estimates are like 80 million people that suffer from acute pain, whether it's from like surgery or trauma or an injury that legitimately need a painkiller. And the fear is if we give them an opiate like we do now, like Percocet, it's great for their pain, but about 10% of those people may get addicted.
Got a call.
I know, I did. Anyhow, so about 10% of those people will get addicted. So we're afraid to prescribe them. But then also, we don't want people to have pain. So now we have this new drug that is effective for pain, moderate pain. So from what I've read, it's about as effective as hydrocodone, which is Percocet, which is pretty good, but not as effective as the stronger opiates like fentanyl. That I think can really be a game changer. I think can really help with the opiate crisis. And, you know, I'm looking forward to having it here, as having it as something in my arsenal that I can prescribe to people who are suffering from pain. And, you know, this sodium channel blocker mechanism is already being used in certain medications for the treat seizures. So we haven't seen addictive potential. So I think it's really promising.
What does it mean, a sodium blocker? Like sodium, we as a regular person, I just only know that as salt. So what is this?
So salt is sodium chloride, but in your cells, you've got sodium channels where it crosses back and forth. So I'd have to give you a little, I'd have to look back in my biochemistry books to how that works. But it's basically involved in the receptor. So it doesn't trigger that pain response.
Okay.
I hope that.
I get it. We just never even think of sodium because we're not supposed to eat it.
But it's true. That's salt. That's sodium chloride. And it's always in a fine balance in our body. Our body does an amazing job of regulating its sodium.
So, talk to me a little bit about the news on GLP and the fact you said that 2/3 of people after 1 year stopped using it, which is so interesting because if people have listened to our previous podcast, we were noticing and noting the pharmaceutical companies that have been reporting their quarterly earnings to give us an update in terms of what's working, what's selling, what's not. And some of them did say that there's a slowdown in these GLP-1s. And I think you and I thought, well, maybe it was the Christmas effect, right? Like people didn't necessarily want to be on these when you can have all the Christmas yummy holiday food. So what did you read about?
So this is what's fascinating. Okay. So 2/3, what this article showed is that, and it was in JAMA, I think it was in JAMA Network, the article, but basically it showed that 2/3 of people that are prescribed GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic that we've talked about for weight loss, not for diabetes, the ones that are prescribed it for weight loss tend to stop that drug within a year of being prescribed. And the reason this is so relevant is because when they are prescribed it for diabetes, it's covered by insurance plans. So they're paying out of pocket. The main reason people are discontinuing this drug when it's prescribed for weight loss has to do with financial reasons. They can't afford it. They don't want to pay for it anymore. So the majority of people are stopping it because it's expensive. And then there were also some people stopping it for moderate side effects. But, you know, think about it. You'd think the side effects would be the same in the diabetic versus the non-diabetic. It's really that financial piece. And I posted on my social media, on my Dr. Melissa Hirschberg social media today, about RFK Jr. talking about, that, you know, GLP-1s aren't the answer and Medicare shouldn't cover it because that would cost them $3 trillion and better to cover healthy food and gym memberships. And I understand where he's coming from. Like, I mean, a healthy food supply is so important and getting better food and getting people active and exercising and eating well, 100%. But what happens when they don't do that? The issue is, you know, I think that if insurance companies and Medicare, you know, if they start paying for more of these drugs, yes, it's going to be really expensive, which is going to be an issue. But on the other hand, it might also lead to cost savings in terms of chronic diseases.
Sure.
To obesity. So it's sort of this, you know, which is going to cost more.
Yeah.
I thought that was, you know, really interesting. It's like we talked about, a lot of people feel the pinch during Christmas because they're buying gifts and they don't want to spend money. And these drugs are expensive and they're only going to get more expensive.
Are they? I would think that they could get cheaper.
I don't know. I don't know if the tariffs, would that affect them?
Oh.
I don't know.
I have not seen anything related to that. I don't know how, we'd have to look into that. But I would just think that, you know, with scale and potentially with generics one day, and even some of the, maybe the political pressure that might ensue, that we could see it lower, because to your point, and the difficulty is, you know, how do you model this out, right? You could say, you, and someone's going to be doing it if they're not doing it already, which is, okay, if you have people on GLPs and they drop 50 pounds, what does that mean for their heart? Less heart attacks, less hip replacements, less knee replacements. The story goes on and on. So how do you model that out? And what's the equilibrium that makes that money make sense?
Right. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I don't envy Paul.
However, what a great segue into AI, because AI is obviously, they're using it to model various scenarios much faster than humans can do, et cetera. Right. So let's talk a little bit about DeepSeek. Did you read or hear much about this week?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I know, it's funny because it's such a scary name.
Deep yeah.
Like, don't you think so? It's like, what's happening? Like,
I know.
You know, but I did read a lot about it. I mean, it's been all over the news. It's been, you know, people talking about, like, this has just rocked the AI world. And, you know, well, you go, you, I mean, you talk
well,
about
no, no. You know, it's helpful for me to hear you say, you go ahead.
So it seems like, you know, American companies have been in this big, huge race to create the best AI models. And there was just a huge investment with Stargate for OpenAI and investing like $500 billion. I can't remember how much, billions of dollars at this race for AI. NVIDIA has been the top performing stock that we make, you know, allows all this to happen. And all of a sudden, this Chinese company, DeepSeek, says, hi, actually, we have our open AI, and it only cost us $6 million to build. And
Right.
We're like, what? You know, we're spending billions and they spent $6 million. So then it led to this whole thing. Well, did they copy OpenAI? Did they steal NVIDIA chips?
Right.
You know, and this is obviously me. I'm not someone in tech. This is just from me, from what I've read and my understanding of it. But yeah, it's pretty crazy. And how is it? And if it's true, and you know, it just shows also that we're in this race with China for AI, and we're in this, you know, kind of economic war with China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So it's, you know, a young guy who started this Chinese AI startup out of a hedge fund, and somehow they have rapidly advanced their AI process, you know, coming from a quant hedge fund that is apparently much more affordable, to your point about it cost them $6 million. And that they are matching some of the performance of these big behemoths that have been spending billions and billions and billions of dollars. And it was only back in December that Microsoft said AI is obviously going to be a big priority for us, and they were going to plan to spend $80 billion. So there's a big question mark in terms of how did they actually do this? To your point, did they use NVIDIA third chips? There's an investigation right now with US officials whether China's DeepSeek purchased some of the advanced NVIDIA semiconductors through third parties in Singapore, circumventing US restrictions on sale of chips for AI. So there's a lot of unknowns here. What it did do, though, and this is sometimes where in the market you'll see big hedge fund money managers sell now and ask questions later. That's a saying on Wall Street and Bay Street. So what did we see? We saw a lot of the AI related companies. So think data centers, energy stocks, because this takes a lot of energy to compute, cooling system companies, VRTVs, one that we've talked about in the past, and NVIDIA all down by 10 to 20%. So that's a massive decline in a stock price. I think we saw about 600, I'm going to get the number right for you.
But, loss.
Yeah, a $600 billion in value loss for NVIDIA. So obviously significant. And the question now, and, you know, this is one of the questions that we got at the end of this, you know, further the end, actually I'll save it. There's a lot of questions now in terms of, are these stocks, have they reset lower? And are they going to stay there? And it's going to be, again, a show me story. These are a lot of the words that we use on Wall Street, but is it a show me story? And there's still a lot of unknowns. On the positive side, some analysts are out there saying, look, if it's true that you can make a somewhat of a comparable product on the AI front much cheaper, that just increases the speed with which AI and the use case for AI can be and will be adopted. So, you know, there's the pros and the cons. And then at the end of the day, Melissa, like you and I always talk about when we look at stock specific stories, what's the story? What's the moat? What are the fundamentals? Where are they positioned within an industry? And then importantly, what's the value of the company? What's the valuation? And is it attractive to me? And that's the big question mark right now as relates to NVIDIA and all these AI stocks. And I don't know that there's an exact answer yet, because I think there's still so many unknowns in terms of who and what DeepSeek actually is. So I think stay tuned for that one.
It's, you know, and also like a lot of people have said that, you know, if they thought that TikTok was spying on us, and if they thought that it was at risk of being banned, wouldn't it be smart to put out DeepSeek, which was obviously the most downloaded app on the App Store by Americans, to swoop in and take over the spying?
That's right.
You can't really stop, you know. You know, everybody was so afraid last week that TikTok was going to be banned and then it wasn't. And I think that you can't really stop this. Like, where does it end then? Are we going to stop using foreign cars because they may be spying on us? But anyhow, or to that point, Trump could come in and say, okay, we banned DeepSeek.
Right.
You know, I don't know. It's just like, it's whenever I hear that name, I think like deep fake, like fake. Whenever I hear the name tariffs, I think scariffs.
Oh my goodness.
I don't know why.
But that's good. That's good.
Yeah. Anyhow, DeepSeek. Yeah.
So I think that's one of the biggest, that's obviously one of the biggest pieces of information in the news this week.
And I don't know, like it didn't, I know some people after NVIDIA's stock fell, they looked at it as a buying opportunity. And then that's why the stock recovered a little bit the next day, because some people went in and bought it. Yeah. Same with some of the other companies that took a hit on this news. You know, like you said, sell first, ask questions later. Well, if they sold and they asked questions, then weren't so worried about it, then it could have been an opportunity to buy. But it makes me afraid, and this can be segue into bonds, you know, for, you know, just the average person here that's thinking that so much of the S&P 500 and so much of the US economy relies on these big seven or magnificent seven or companies that are all so AI invested, you know, if all of a sudden that goes flat or, you know, do we need to look at some safer or other alternatives? And that's when I started thinking about bonds. And
is that why you asked me about bonds? Was because
I'm being totally honest. And I'm just like
so interesting.
Yeah. Because a lot of people's portfolios have just been like, the economy's been booming. The market's been up. It's been up. It's been up. Everybody's so in equities. You know, it used to be like, I remember when I first started, you know, investing there, you know, it was like, well, you should be conservative and 60-40, 60 equities and 40 fixed income. And some of that fixed income is bonds. But now it seems like everybody's like so highly weighted in equities, and it's gotten out of, you know, and so it just made me think about it a little bit more and about fixed income portion of my portfolio. And that's why I was asking. And the reason I was asking about bonds too is because, you know, if you're on one of these direct investing platforms, you can just go and buy a stock, but you can't just go and buy an individual bond. You can buy an ETF of bonds. But, you know, it's like, how does the average person that's a do-it-yourself investor buy bonds? So that's why.
Okay. So we'll get to that in just one second. I think what's interesting about what you said though, Melissa, about the market has been driven by these Mag Sevens, the big tech companies. For anybody who's listening, what the Mag Seven is, like Google, Meta, which is Facebook, Apple, Tesla. So those companies have really been carrying the market higher. But what I also, so I looked at, you know, you and I both own an ETF that represents the S&P 500. And I was looking at it the other day, I'm like, hey, it's up, but it's not up that much. And it's because of what we're talking about, the downdraft in these AI stocks weighting the market down. But that's also why you and I own company specific stories and not just the market. So that's where it all comes together, right? And so what I would say as well, when we think about the market right now, is that the inflows into the US equity markets have been actually very strong, because there is, as we talk about, that animal spirit, believing that President Trump is going to unleash the regulatory burden on companies, specifically in the finance, as you know, financial companies. And also, you know, if he's unleashing animal spirits and lowering taxes, that that helps small cap companies. So that's a whole nother area of the market that we'll talk about another time, but small cap companies, smaller companies in general. So just small companies, that's always the engine of an economy, right? And we have way more in the States that are publicly traded than we do in Canada. It's a much bigger market, as we've talked about. So there is the possibility that there's an opportunity in owning small cap companies now, as opposed to just these S&P 500 large cap companies. And there are ETFs that, again, represent what's called the Russell 2000. That's an index of 2000 small cap companies in the United States. You can pick your small cap companies if you want to own one specific, or you can buy the index. So that's a segue. Mm-hmm. Or not a segue. That's just, you know, something I thought about, because
the one way, if you're worried about these, like the index and just these big Magnificent Seven, you can also look at, you know, small cap companies, dividend paying stocks, which I think
that's right
about.
Yeah.
And then crypto. So I was I saw something that said, you know, what, how to make money in Trump's America. AI.
Oh, that's why you sent that to me too.
That's why I sent that to you.
I was like, why are you sending me
that? I was like, how are we going to make money over the next 4 years? It's Trump. It seems like he's, this is where he wants it to go. So, you know, yeah. So AI.
Crypto, yes, and we've seen that reflected in the price. But why don't we just talk a little bit about bonds? We'll do that. Okay, so the question is, what is a bond? It's when you lend money to a borrower, like a government or a corporation. And you might sit there and say, I'm just a small person. What government or corporation wants my money? Well, they do. And they go out and they issue bonds. And they hope that big pension funds or other sovereign wealth funds, big institutions, this tends to be more of an institutional buy than a retail buy. We'll get to how you can do it. But they do need people's money, like yours or somebody else's. And in exchange for that, you give them your money. They give you regular payments over a set period of time. Okay? So they'll give you, what's that?
It's like you're loaning the money and they pay you interest on that.
That's right. It's the opposite of what you do with your mortgage, right? The bank lends you money and you pay them an interest payment plus principal. They don't pay you principal. They pay you, but the principal you get paid at the end. So the principal is the amount that you give them. So let's just say you give them $1,000. At the end of the term, or what's called maturity, you'll get all your money back. Unlike a stock, you put $1,000 in, you don't know if it's going to 10,000 or zero. A bond, you will get back that money as long as they don't default. The country doesn't default. The corporation doesn't default. So you do your analysis in terms of whether or not you think they're going to default or not. But in general, you invest on a maturity level for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and you get that money back at the end of whatever that term is.
And along the way, they're paying you interest to hold that money.
That's correct. That's correct. So short-term bonds are 1 to 3 years, medium-term are 4 to 10, long-term are greater than 10. So you decide on how long do I want to lock this money away for, okay? And you also ask yourself, what am I getting? What coupon? So the interest payment that they give you is called a coupon. You clip the coupons, clipping coupons. So just picture that in your head. You're just taking a coupon off, and that's your interest payment. Okay. So if, as an example, I'm just going to pull this out of my head a bit, but say a 4 year, so I'm going to make the math easy. Say it's a 10 year bond and they're going to give you 4%. You get 4% on whatever amount you put in there for the next 10 years and it matures what's called at par. So par means $100, $1,000, $100,000. So it's always 100.
But because of inflation, are you getting back the exact amount or the exact plus inflation?
You're getting your $1,000 back and you are collecting that 4% for all those years. So you made a face. Okay.
Loving that. Getting $10,000 back 10 years from now. $10,000 isn't worth the same 10 years now as it is today.
Well, but we don't know. And that's where you have, you're taking on the time risk, right? So if you are going to invest for 10 years, you are going to expect a higher rate versus short term. Okay.
You higher interest the longer you let them hold your money.
Yeah, because there's a lot more risk. There's time risk, there's inflation risk, there's default risk. Mm-hmm. So yes, you tend to get higher rates the longer the duration or the longer the maturity. So that's something to think about. Right now, because we don't really know where inflation is going because of the tariffs, we also have a Bank of Canada that just lowered the interest rates by 25 basis points, which we know is 0.25%. That also had an impact of weakening the Canadian dollar. It weakens the overall interest rate picture here in Canada, because remember, if you have a choice, say currency, say you had US and Canadian dollars, that didn't matter. If you could invest in Canada at 4% or the United States at 5%, you go where you get paid the higher rate and whose economy is stronger. So when you have when you're a central bank that's lowering rates, it's actually harder to raise money. You have to offer a higher rate to attract foreign capital in, or to attract a current buyer sitting in Canada. So all of that gets computed into what interest rate you and me as an investor will get. And because there are so many unknowns right now, right, with inflation or deflation and where will interest rates go next, et cetera, I'm personally looking at bonds right now and I'm thinking, I don't want a 10-year. I don't think I want a 5-year. I'm thinking I want a 2 to 3 year. And a lot of the strategists right now out there, that's kind of what they're recommending.
I feel the same. And so just intuitively, I would feel the same way. Cause it's sort of like, I don't know, let's see what's going on in the next couple of years.
Right. However, if you're somebody who thinks that AI is going to be deflationary because it's going to replace so many jobs, that saves corporations money, then interest rates might naturally go down. And therefore, the rates we're seeing today, 2 years from now, will be considered high. So I should invest longer term. So what some people, that's not my view. It's not a lot of strategist view. You understand the concept. So what you might do and what you might see portfolio managers do is they will ladder their bond purchases.
Okay. This before, you're not a fan of buying ETF of bonds?
I'm not, unless it's a very active strategy. In other words, I have invested in a energy bond portfolio that did inordinately well. And we'll get to the price of bonds now, which is the reason why it did so well. This was a number of years ago, was because bonds are issued at $100. Okay. They mature at $100. Okay. You get your $100 back. But in between now and 5 years from now, that bond price will move. It could go down $10 to $90. It could go up to $110. It could go down to $70. And I'll get to the reasons. There are a number of reasons why that will happen. Most don't move that much. Okay. But the reason why the energy bond fund was so interesting was because going back 8-10 years ago, when the energy sector in Canada was so vilified, remember, right? There was concern that a lot of these energy companies were going to go bankrupt. So some of these bonds were trading at what's called 70 cents on the dollar, or $70 to the $100. That's a $30 discount.
Right.
Okay. So there was an opportunity. If you didn't, if you believed, and I did, in this money manager whose thesis was, we need energy. These companies are not going to go bankrupt, the good ones. So he went in and bought the bonds of good energy companies that were trading at, you know, 70 cents to the dollar, 65 cents to the dollar. So, and then everybody realized that they were going to survive. Those bond prices reflected it. And we made all that money from 70 up to, so that's 30% up to 100. Plus we got a coupon. Plus we got the interest payment.
And growth.
Interest and growth.
Okay.
Interest and capital gains. Exactly. Exactly. Now, the opposite is true too. Sometimes, you know, the bonds will be trading above par. So par is $100. And the reason they're trading above par is often because they have a, you know, attributes that make them more valuable. Could be the coupon. It could be the sector, number of different reasons. So when, but when it matures, you lose that capital gain. So if you bought it at 102, you get your $100 back. You lose that, but they've probably paid you a bigger coupon, an interest payment. Okay. That might be a bit too technical for now.
Technical, but I think these conversations are good because over time we're learning more and understanding more of the lingo and, you know, helping to figure out how to make some decisions. So like to your point, if you want to buy an ETF of a bond, you can just go on your direct investing platform and buy it. But if you want to buy the individual bond, you have to call.
Sorry. To correct you, if you want to buy a bond fund, you can go on your ETF platform and, you know, they're fine. They will manage a bond fund for you and they are big institutional players and you will pay a management fee. And, you know, depending on where bonds are trading, if you want that money out, you might not be getting it at par. You will get whatever the unit value is. So a fund represents the unit value of all of those bonds.
With an individual bond, if you pull your money out before the term, do you still get it all back or is there a penalty?
You get the price of whatever the bond is trading at.
Okay.
So just as an example too, when you think about the bond market versus the equity market, the global fixed income market. So bonds are part of fixed income. Fixed meaning fixed, right? Fixed coupon, fixed interest payment, fixed, you know, you get your money back at maturity, fixed income. The global fixed income or bond market is $140.7 trillion at the end of 2023. That's about 20% bigger than the global equity market. The equity market is about 115 trillion. Again, these are dated numbers, but just gives you the size. So it's a very, very large number. And it's because there's so many corporations and companies and sovereigns that, you know, need to issue bonds. And you say, well, why do they need to issue bonds? They have all of my taxpayer money, doesn't cover it, doesn't cover the school, doesn't cover the highways, doesn't cover the hospitals. So that's why, and it doesn't cover their debt. That's so they have to issue bonds because they need to borrow money to pay off the debt.
Let me ask you a question going back to tariffs. So with Trump putting in these 25% tariffs on Canadian goods, if American companies still say, you know what, the Canadian dollar is so weak, screw it. I'm still going to purchase it from Canada and I'm going to pay that 25% tax. Do you think Trump's doing it because he wants to make money, the government to make money on those taxes? Like he wants to, like it's a cash grab?
Well, I don't know if it's a cash, I'm not going to say it's a cash grab, but yeah, is he going to make
that layman's term?
Yeah. Is he going to make money on it? Sure, he's collecting a tax.
Yeah, it's 25% tax that, you know.
Yeah.
Seems like a good way to get some money.
It does. It actually does.
Yeah. So I think Trump's all about the money.
From The Apprentice?
From The Apprentice.
Yeah. That was so good. Very clever, thanks. Melissa.
Yeah.
Did you watch that show?
I loved that show.
Loved the show.
I loved it. he's an entertaining guy.
Yeah.
You know, part of the reason that he's being voted for. I mean, yes, he's a smart guy and he's well read and he's whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he's a very entertaining person.
Speaking
and it was interesting to watch the business and I liked it.
So good. And, you know, I feel like, too, it did give, I mean, look, in the early days, I think it really did give people an opportunity to get exposure to him, get exposure to business, get exposure to someone who's tough. I've seen people from those shows. It did set their careers. It did actually help.
Yeah. Was that the original reality show?
Yeah.
I feel like it used to be a reality TV. That was one of the original. And now I feel like reality TV is just the world. Like just...
Yeah, it's the world.
Looking at your phone, and which will segue into the next thing. Like,
okay,
phone, the amount of news we're exposed to, and social media telling us about the news. It's like we're living a reality show constantly.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't surprised. I saw this article. It came up, I think, in Medscape or something, one of the emails I get. It was a big study done that showed that social media use is linked to increased irritability. Shocker.
Shocker.
And it said, okay, so it was an internet survey that was done looking at the relationship between social media use and frequency of posting and irritability scores. So they used an index called the Brief Irritability Test. I'd actually like to take that test.
Yeah.
I think I'd score high. I'd score really high at certain times of the month.
Yes. Or even when somebody just came in as we're trying to film and he's asking you about your ski equipment.
Yeah, don't take my skis, put them to Sport Swap or wherever. Just let me
focus.
Let me focus. Yeah, exactly. But anyhow, it said that the thing that was correlated to the most increased irritability was the frequency of political discussions you had online.
Oh,
the more political posts and the more political discussions, the higher irritability in your everyday life. And I think we've seen that, right? And I think we've seen people get really heated when they talk about these things. And probably that's why they're, you know, addicted to that dopamine rush from that, getting that jolt of, you know, that feeling, you know.
Wow. You know, what we should do too, and I've looked at this, Melissa, is let's, for the next thing, and there, we can all easily Google it, but I think it'd be important and interesting to talk about different ways to get your dopamine rush.
Yeah.
You know, because obviously alcohol is one of them. But what you said, which I didn't actually ask about on the previous clips that we did, but it was so interesting that you said that part of the dopamine rush when you're drinking is just the idea of it. So it's not even the alcohol, which I think is because it was fun to have our dry Secco.
Yeah.
It was good enough.
Well, they show that with like drug users and stuff like that. Already the paraphernalia associated with it will start to give them the feelings of the rush. Same thing with food addicts. Ordering Uber Eats, getting the excitement, thinking about it already is giving you a boost. And, you know, there's a great book called Dopamine Nation. I forget the author. I listen to a podcast with her. She's amazing. And it talks about we're so addicted. I mean, dopamine, we used to have to work hard for dopamine. In other words, that reward feeling. We used to have to go, you know, you wanted to eat, you're hungry. You had to go out and hunt and catch it and get it and prepare it in order to get it. Now it's like a click away with Uber Eats. You know, we used to work hard for these feelings and now it's just so much easier and you can get dopamine in different ways. So, you know, what's your drug of choice? For some people, it's food, right? And we have the epidemic because they get addicted to these processed foods. For some people, it's alcohol. For some people, it's, you know, actual, you know, hard drugs. For some people, it's gambling. For some people, it's investing on, or not even investing, but it's stock trading.
Yeah.
For some people, it's sex. There's different ways to get it. And there's ways to get it. And then there's the good ways to get exercise is also huge. And that's why you get the runner's high, people that get addicted to working out.
They really are addicted, aren't they?
Yeah, skiing. You know, don't you notice it too? After you have a good day on the hills and you're skiing, you have that rush, you feel good.
Yeah.
So ways to get dopamine.
But back to your point on the social media, I'm surprised that people get dopamine from that.
And from likes. From likes.
From likes.
When you post a video and you're like, wow, look how many views I got. Look how many likes I got. It gives you a rush. It gives you that quick hit of dopamine. And then you want to do it again. And you want to do it again.
Interesting.
seeking it and you're seeking it out, or just getting the socialization and the engagement from someone, you know.
Right. So but this study, so it increased irritability. I'm surprised that that was the metric that they wanted to look at.
Well, I think it increases a lot. Social media use is like, I mean, it's a huge problem. Like,
yeah.
And adults and everybody, we're all just like glued to our, we're glued to it. We're all hooked on it. It's how we get our, how we get our entertainment. It's how we communicate with friends.
Right. It's
how we get, it's the new way to get information.
Yeah.
Information that way. Like, we're just very much, it's a part of our lives. So we need to figure out how to balance it better. Or not, or this AI is going to accelerate even further and we're just going to become human bots.
I know. And I know your theory on that.
There's this show, it's really good, called Upload. I don't know if you've ever, it's like a futuristic type of thing, but their hand basically is their phone.
And right.
Their AI version of, their avatar version of themselves and their real version of themselves. But I actually don't think it's so far off from what could be the reality. It was also different. Like, they uploaded, once you die, you got uploaded into this world. It's, anyhow, it's a cool show.
Interesting. Disturbing.
So, but you know, it actually is scary. Like, the speed with which AI is happening and the speed with which it allows things to be done is just, it's anxiety provoking. It's irritability.
It is
like, you get a message and you feel like you have to respond right away. We all have this constant pressure that, you know, like, you got to act now, you got to do this now, you got to, you know, it's just not relaxing as life, I don't think.
No, it's not. And you know, it's interesting because when I did go to the ranch, that health spot, what was so amazing, which I didn't know or wasn't planning on counting on, was it was also, and they talked about this, it was a massive digital detox.
Yeah.
And in part because, you know, they don't really want you walking around with your phone. People did. I didn't. And you're so removed for just 3 days that it actually transforms you. You sleep better, wake up energized. Like, it's so amazing. And, you know, I was just thinking, Melissa, when I was on air full time and doing, like, you know, 3.5-4 hours a day, and even just during the first Trump administration, you know, there was always so much news coming at you. And this was when social media wasn't even nearly as evolved. And I'm telling you, you would go home so exhausted. And so think about if everybody now is kind of living that TV anchor life 24/7, not even 4 hours a day. That's a lot. It's too much.
Yeah. It's a bit of information overload and everybody's sitting on their phones. And also it's like, no one can enjoy one thing. Like, now it's like you're watching a movie, but you're on your phone at the same time. I just get away from being like present.
But yeah. Okay.
Our life. Okay, so I wanted to talk about another thing that I saw about
calcium.
Calcium and colorectal cancer risk. So we know with colorectal cancer, so there are reports that cancer rates are increasing in younger people, specifically in people between the ages of, we're seeing more cancer in people between the ages of 20 and 49 than previously. And it's like, what's causing this? So a lot of people, so we know known risk factor for colorectal cancer is alcohol and processed meats. So we know that eating those things increases your risk of colon cancer. Okay. But what can protect us? So just in my mind, I always thought, well, fiber, eating like a rich fiber diet is healthy for your colon. But actually the one thing that said was very protective was dietary calcium cuts colorectal cancer risk by 17%. So it said colorectal cancer is the third most common cancer worldwide. Higher rates are actually observed in higher income countries. Alcohol and processed meats are known carcinogens and increased risk. But actually, when they did a study, they tracked dietary factors in 550,000 women over 16 years. And during this time, they looked at about 12,000 of those women developed cancer. And the women that were diagnosed with cancer, they tended to be generally older, obviously taller, which I found interesting, had a higher, obviously, family history risk, but also the calcium intake showed the strongest protective association. So each 300 milligrams per day of calcium consumed, which is equivalent to about the large glass of milk, was associated with 17% reduced risk in colon cancer.
Wow.
Yeah. So other things that were also protective were dairy milk, yogurt, riboflavin, magnesium, phosphorus, and potassium, as well as whole grains and fiber. But what it also showed is that it wasn't necessarily calcium that had to come from a food source. It was just the elemental, it was just the calcium itself. And they thought maybe a mechanism proposed was that maybe it binds bile acids in the colon. But it's just, you know, a lot of people.
That's great news.
Yeah. So I think, like, I goes to show you again, like a healthy diet, and you've talked about this, trying to increase your protein. If you don't have like a lactose intolerance issue or anything, like I love, like I have Greek yogurt pretty much every single day.
Yeah. Wow.
Good source of calcium
and protein. Yeah.
And it's got good probiotics as well. So I think a lot of years ago, people were very anti-dairy, and I think it's coming back in vogue a little bit.
I think it's so coming back.
Yeah.
So coming back.
You know, let's go for our Canadian made dairy.
Yay.
Yeah. But anyhow, so that if you can eat milk, then you can also take like a calcium chew or a calcium supplement. You just don't want to obviously overdo it. Again, we have to think about the dose. Like, don't read this the wrong way and think like, oh, I'm going to take so much calcium. The next thing you know, you get kidney stones or anything like
right.
that.
Just right. Because that can happen too.
Yeah. But right? So, your diet, if you don't eat dairy, think about a calcium supplement and try to eat a whole, you know, a smart, balanced, healthy, whole foods diet. So think about, you know, lean dairy. So lean.
Can I tell you, Melissa? So we're down in Naples, and Les, my husband, had an opportunity to go with the guys last night. If he was off the hook, okay. And I'm like, oh, there's no hook. Like, there's no hook.
Okay.
And so anyway, I'm like, this is fantastic, because rather than going out and having to choose the healthiest thing to eat, I ordered from True Food, I think it was, which is all like organic and, you know, spaghetti squash and grains. And I was like, you know, I was in heaven. He's like, do you want me to bring you back something from the restaurant? I'm like, no. So it's like, it's just so nice to be able to, you know, focus and do that. Not that we do that all the time, but I'm just saying it's, you know, there's so many temptations out there, right?
It's hard to eat healthy when you're eating out a lot and ordering in food. It's much easier when you're making your own food and you're in charge of your own ingredients and sauces and you know what goes into it.
Yeah.
You own a restaurant. You want people to come back. You want people to want the food to taste good. What makes food taste good? Sugar, salt, and fat. So they're going to put that in the food to get you to come back, to get the food to taste good, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wait, sorry. This place is called True Food Kitchen.
Oh, interesting. Is it only? Yeah.
I think they have a few. I'll have to look it up. True Food Kitchen. Okay. It's great. But no, that's really interesting. Oh, question though, with respect to when you said getting a kidney stone, so I always take vitamin D, but I've also been told, so I've been doing it, you have to take vitamin D with vitamin K so that it doesn't calcify and you don't get a kidney stone. I don't know if you've heard that, or there is an issue with too much calcium, and calcium's in spinach too. So if people are prone to kidney stones, then you have to watch that.
You wouldn't get it from, it's hard to get the calcium from food isn't often linked to kidney stones as much as taking calcium like in a supplement.
Oh.
But it might be the oxalate in the spinach. That's also like the one type of kidney stones, calcium oxalate stones. But yeah, they often do recommend you take the K2 with the vitamin D. So yeah, I think it's,
I think
it's what to do. It's funny, like I find that like whenever I test my vitamin D, I don't take a vitamin D supplement. Just because I don't remember and I don't. And also when I've tested it, my vitamin D levels are always very good. So, and I put sunscreen on and I live in Canada. So I don't know if it's necessarily the sunlight or maybe it is because I eat dairy. But I often find an association in blood work with people that have a lot of inflammation tend to have low vitamin D levels. And people that tend to eat very healthy and have low inflammation tend not to. So,
Okay. Interesting. Melissa, let's just go back to 1 second, dividends and bonds. We talked about bonds. Is that all right? And then we'll wrap it in about not too long.
We have questions also.
We got to get the questions in.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, when you think about even why you want to invest in a bond, it's because you want regular income and you want to know that you are going to get your principal back, right? That's your $1,000. It's also a way to diversify your portfolio. So it's, you know, it's a way to kind of just buy and hold. Now, bonds are tradable. So if you wanted that money out, you could sell it.
Not going to lose your money. Like in the stock market, people worry, oh my God, I could lose my money if the stock market goes down.
If you hold it to maturity, it matures at par, which is $1,000. So that, and there's a lot more to discuss on that, but we can pick it up because I am looking at bonds for myself. Now, the one thing most bonds, if you want to make a bond purchase, are for government bonds, it's like $100,000 purchase.
So in other words, there's a minimum. Well, and like yes. There's a minimum amount, which is why you said that's more institutional investors, people that have big pools of money rather than.
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely. But I am asking about what, because I'm also looking at corporate bonds for myself personally. And I'll see what those numbers are and I'll give them to you next time. But the other thing too, is I'm also looking at the bonds versus a GIC right now, guaranteed investment certificate. So, you know, if you don't want to fool around, if you don't want to invest in the bond market, you know, there's GICs that are somewhat comparable. But you'll never get that discount to par and then make that capital gain, right?
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. And their rates are probably a little bit lower, but again, because there's so many unknowns right now, the rates, the interest payments that you'll get aren't too different.
Yeah.
Okay. So just let's talk about dividends for 1 second. We did do a little clip on this that we put out, but dividends are basically just a portion of a company's earnings that are distributed to any shareholders, like anybody who owns the stock. So like I said before, and you don't have to own a company. You can own a stock. You own a Pete. That means you're actually an owner of Pepsi. You're an owner of Coca-Cola. You're an owner of CN Rail. That's pretty cool, I think. And so, you know, if you own a dividend stock, you're not just waiting and expecting for that stock price to increase. You're also getting paid part of the profits. So
bond, you can correlate it with it saying it's sort of like your interest payment, like a bond pays you the interest while you're,
That's exactly it. It's an interest payment from a bond or it's profits from a corporation. And, you know, the sectors, we've talked a little bit about this, that tend to pay dividends are the ones that have stable cash flows. So in other words, they have constant customer base. So think telecom companies or utilities, you're going to pay your gas bill, or it's a consumer staples company like food, beverage, household. Regardless of the economy, they're still probably going to be buying toilet paper, Kleenex, et cetera, right? You also have REITs, so real estate investment trusts, so real estate companies that by law distribute their profits. And then you have some healthcare companies. So those are the certain sectors and financials, of course, that tend to pay out their profits. The opposite of that is if you're a growth company or a tech company, you retain all those earnings because you're saying, I'm going to put all that money, all my earnings back into the company so that I can create the next best iPhone. That's why they don't necessarily give out the money. Okay. What I will also say though, is there's what's called the dividend aristocrats. So those are companies that have basically been increasing their dividend payout. So rather than just always you making 5%, every year they increase it. And so, and for at least like 20 years. So there's some money managers who say, hey, like I like buying dividend companies, but I'm going to buy the company that is so good. They increase their payment to me every year. And those stocks actually tend to also outperform on the stock price. Because they're kind of getting rewarded for being such good stewards of cash and capital. I want to point out as well.
Do you have an example of those, in your opinion?
Do I have an example? No, but I'll get you one. I just didn't have time. But what I, you know, it's funny. I'd forgotten about that wording, dividend aristocrats. But as I, and I've said this to you before, you know, I've been creating a nice dividend portfolio because as I say, it's my money making me money. It's making me income without doing anything other than doing a little bit of homework and picking some good companies. Then I just sit there and I collect the money.
Yeah.
So And, you know, you can collect it and you can then buy a condo. You can go on a vacation. You can do all these things. But what I want to also point out, which is really important, is, you know, some companies will pay a dividend and then guess what? Something happens and they can't pay the dividend anymore. And that those stocks get hit. So as an example, big news this week, I had to look at it. Walgreens, the big drugstore company in the States, they suspended their dividend. Okay, they have been paying a dividend for 90 years, 90 years. And it was back in 2024, they'd already cut their dividend because they needed to decrease their debt. They're turning around their operations. They're decreasing stores. So you have to pay money to close stores.
Maybe Walgreens the one, okay, now I could be totally wrong, but I think I'm not, is Walgreens the one that they put this huge investment in these digital freezers that were also advertising and then they didn't work and now they have to take it out of all of their stores?
No idea. Okay, look it up. I mean, I wonder, was it digital freezers for pharmacy?
It was these digital. Let me see. Digital. Okay. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Digital ad.
Was it digital freezers? That doesn't even make sense.
Like when you went to go buy something,
mm-hmm.
they, instead of like just being able to see the food, you had to touch on a screen what it was. And they thought it would be a good idea to do that. And then it would also allow.
I got it.
Isn't that right? Is it Walgreens or not?
Okay, but by the way, I just used AI to figure this out.
And see how much faster you were than me. I'm still frustrated. Yeah.
Okay, yes.
I'm Walgreens. Looking for an encyclopedia.
I know. I just used my Grok. Okay. Yes, Walgreens did implement digital freezer doors in some of its stores. These were part of a partnership with a company called Cooler Screens, which started around 2018. The initiative involved replacing traditional glass doors and refrigerator and freezer units with digital screens that could display ads, product information, images of what was inside the coolers without opening them. However, this project encountered numerous issues, technical failures, customer dissatisfaction, legal battles, financial implications. There you go. Yep, yeah. You got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So that.
That was a bad idea from them. So there you go. They need the money. They can't be paying it out to people. They need it to get
rid
of bad freezer things.
So the story and the lesson is, despite the fact that they were paying dividends for 90 years, we still always have to kind of do a bit of our homework, stay on top of the fundamentals of the story.
And that probably will lead to a sell-off of the stock too, because maybe people are only holding it because they wanted their dividend. They cut their dividend, people are going to sell the stock.
Melissa, that happens a lot. Not a lot. When it happens, it's very devastating for people who owned it for exactly those reasons. Devastating.
Yeah.
You know, for your retiree. Absolutely. Yeah. All right, we're going to wrap it up. But you end with the question.
Yes. Okay, so let me read it.
It has to do with Botox, everybody. So stay tuned if you like Botox.
Okay. Hi, Dr. Hirschberg. I'm a huge fan of the podcast and listen weekly. I used to watch Catherine on BNN for years. I wanted to inquire if you may be able to shed some light on Botox in one of the episodes. I'm 37 and just started getting regular Botox every 3 to 4 months, about 2 years ago. I'm just wondering if there's any downside risk to the continued treatment over the long term. Some friends of mine have mentioned taking a break from it for extended periods of time and claim to get immune to the results. Do you think there's any truth to this? And should people take extended breaks from Botox every so often? Some friends also claim that prolonged use over time could end up actually aging me over time and having weird effects on my skin. So far, I love Botox and even got my husband on board last time. I'd love your take. Okay.
That's a great husband.
Yeah. That's nice, you know?
Yeah.
So this is a discussion a lot of people have with me, and they, you know, do they need to take a break? So the short answer is no. So first of all, any friend that's telling you to take an extended break from Botox might want to steal your boyfriend. Okay.
Okay.
So it's also the same thing. People used to think you have to take a break from the birth control pill if you want to get pregnant. You have to take. So trials have shown that about 1.5% of people do develop some antibodies to Botox, and that it will stop working over time. But that's a very small percentage of people. Most people, it's actually the opposite. That what can happen from doing Botox is from repeatedly temporarily paralyzing that muscle, it could actually atrophy and cause a little bit of muscle loss in the area. So the muscle actually gets weaker over time. Sorry,
that's okay.
So
you weaken the muscle. That doesn't sound very good.
Well, it can be, right? Because if our muscles are so strong, they're making big wrinkles. If we weaken them and they're not as strong anymore, it's kind of a good thing. You're going to need a lower dose of Botox. Hmm. So for example, some people that get Botox in the masseter muscle, because they might have really strong jaws or they have pain with, you know, with clenching, over time, the muscle just naturally gets weaker and they no longer have to do it. So that's a good thing that happens with that, using it for that intended purpose. But what happens is some people find as they're aging, you may naturally end up needing a little bit more of a dose because you're getting older. So you might feel like it's wearing off more quickly. It also could be you have to look at your injector. They not may not be using the same product. Hang on one second.
Yeah. Might not be using the same product.
Yeah. So they may not be using the same quality of product.
Oh.
Diluting it a little bit more to make it last longer. Okay.
Diluting it.
Yeah. Hi, I'm doing the podcast, so I'll call you later. Bye. Oh, kids. Oh, my God.
Oh, okay.
A million times in a row. Anyhow, so that, you know, could be one of the things. And also, if it does find it's happening, there's different brands of botulinum toxin now. So let's say I often change it up. So if I've been using Botox in somebody, I may switch it up every now and then and switch to Dysport or switch to Xeomin. They're also, you know, botulinum toxin, but they just have a slightly different formulation. So that can help... you know, stave off any resistance. But generally speaking, no, I don't think it's important to take a break. I think, I've had patients for 15 years using the same dose and everything working well. And then you might just get to a stage where, you know, 20 years later, 25 years later, where you need something a little stronger than Botox.
Right.
Knocking on the surgeon's door. But
yeah,
generally speaking, I think, you don't need to worry about that unless you're doing it too frequently. You don't want to be doing it like monthly. You want to wait for it to start to wear off about the 3-month window and then do it.
Mm, okay. That's a good point too. Cause I feel like I'm surprised at how many young people do this. So.
And also you don't want to use like, I also think it's nice to do Botox to soften lines, but if you over Botox and overly freeze an area, what can happen is you can look more aged. You know, sometimes if you're, you know, it's normal to have a little bit of movement in your face. And if you're in your 20s or early 30s and you're completely frozen, you might look a little bit older than you actually are because only an older person would be doing that. You know, it doesn't look
easy. Yeah. Yeah.
And also it can force other muscles to take over. So what I used to see is when people used to do so much Botox in their forehead and in their belly between their brows to make expressions, they used to create these other weird lines in their nose because they else to make expressions. So go to an experienced injector. If you want to look natural, make sure that you express that to them. And yeah.
Okay. Awesome. All right. A lot in this episode.
So much. It was a big
week. Okay. Busy week. Okay. We'll see you soon.
Okay.
Bye. Okay. Bye.